This is tape two, side two, Gus Schubert interview, 7/17/92. Ouch. Picking up on a few additional points from our discussion, you had mentioned earlier the fact that, in general, the economic staff was reasonably enthusiastic and interested in the idea of going into domestic research, as we've talked about it, but the social science group was not. And I'd be interested in having you kind of elaborate on the reasons for that. On the surface, you think they might be equally interested.
Well, I think not if you appreciate that at the time, the social science group was not a social science group. It was a group essentially of political scientists. Herb Goldhammer, who had by then died, was an exception, having been a sociologist. He no doubt would have been as enthusiastic as he could be about anything to this idea. But most of the members of the social science department were political scientists of the traditional variety. They were international affairs, international relations, armchair strategy types, big world think types, who had no real interest in the internal workings of the country. I don't think Rand had published more than two or three R's or serious papers on domestic political concerns or concerns that would be appropriate to a political scientist. And their whole tradition was oriented toward the Cold War, relations with the Soviet Union, NATO problems, and that sort of thing. And that's simply where their interests were. So that the economists, on the other hand, for some reason, some peculiar reason that I don't understand, I've always found to be sort of interested in going on to new and different kinds of things. And that's certainly been the case at Rand. And another exception, incidentally, in the social science thing is Deborah Hensler. She was a member of that department, but she was not a political scientist. She is a, she is a political scientist, but she's a quantitative person trained at MIT. And had natural inclinations toward field research and experience in field research. And I hired her from UCLA. I guess I'm getting my chronology a little bit mixed up. She came in after the fact of the establishment of the division. She ended up in that department because it was convenient. And it was beginning to become a social science department. So the economists just found it easier somehow to and more desirable to translate their work into issues concerning new things, and they were always on the lookout for new things. And you know, I'm not saying all of them by any means, but I'm saying sort of a key group was always there. I mean, let's go back in tradition. Albert was doing something new. Bert Klein was doing something new when he got into R&D. He didn't do any more. We're still doing it. Saints preserve me. It's a field that I was engaged in. Bert and I used to work together in it. And I don't note any, you know, I'm probably wrong, but I don't note any great difference between what's being done now and what Bert finished 20 years ago. But when he got into the field, it was new. And when the field had matured, then he was interested in getting into other things. And he got into NATO affairs. And then when Harry came back, he didn't think very much of Harry. And he thought even less of Albert, as you could probably tell from that tape. So he went to Caltech. I think he was a great loss to Rand. So it's something I can't really explain. It's just something that, in my perception, was there, and it was certainly true when I went to form something that you might call a domestic division or a domestic effort or whatever. At lunch, we were talking about, you know, how did we go about forming the division, and where did the people come from, and all that kind of thing. And my strategy was not dissimilar from the strategy of putting together the budget without the financial details. I asked myself the classical Rand questions. What are the areas in which we're most likely to have a comparative advantage, where Rand will be better than anybody else? Who is here who has the intellect, the credentials, and the willingness to take on responsibility in this area? Is it likely that we will find sufficient scope for this person to pull together a team and to be effective in working on one or more subjects in the broad area, let's say, of education or health? And we sort of made an initial selection, which, as I emphasized earlier, was very flexible. Things came in, things dropped out. And invariably, when I established a program, I had a person to lead that program before I ever set pen to paper to put a program together. And many of those people came from the economics department, and many of them were volunteers. I mean, I wasn't going out and dragooning people. These were people who were coming on in. So we had John Pincus, we had in education and the California program, who an economist. We had Lee Johnson from the economics department in the communications area. We had my memory is simply failing me, but most of the leaders of what turned out to be the major programs, with the exception of criminal justice, were out of the economics department. And you know, that caused a fair amount of resentment. But that resentment's always been there. You know, the economists have always been looked upon by the rest of Rand as somebody who's always causing people, they're always causing people trouble by doing new and different troublesome things, whether it be for the Air Force or anybody else.
Did Rand management see these transfers of people over to from the national security side to domestic as creating holes?
Were no, they because I mean, not in most instances, because you'll recall it became coincident with a period of cutbacks on the security side. Right. So the security side's problem was how to conserve resources. The domestic side, their problem was how to get good people. And so just like the reversal, which I told you about during the last big fracas, where when people had to be let go, they were let go from the national security side by and large, and their places were taken by people from the domestic side. Well, the beginning was the reverse of that. And although these people were generally not without experience in some of the fields, either as an avocation or as part of their professional work. Steve Carroll, an economist who took a leading role in education. George Eads, who took a leading role in regulation, economist. And the other main source that I think about it, especially when I think about New York, was the operations research systems analysis kind of field. People like Peter Greenwood, who was out of the then systems sciences department, I think it was called, who has an industrial engineering OR background. He was the man who led the criminal work. And in New York, the police work, the fire work, were both led by OR types, systems analysis types. The health work was led by a systems type. The housing work was led by an economist. So it was that kind of mixture. And the political scientists simply, it just wasn't within their span of interest, really. So they weren't volunteering for things like this. As it became obvious that we needed more and more social scientists with different backgrounds, for example, it became obvious that we needed with a burgeoning health program that we needed much, much better access to physicians. And we thought it very unlikely that RAND alone would be able to attract physicians to the research staff. And that was true then. I don't think it's so true now, because systems analysis or policy analysis of health problems has now become a field in which there are many physicians aspiring to become active or are already active. It's become a specialty. There's a thing called the Clinical Scholars Program, funded by the, the Johnson Foundation, which is designed to take MDs and train them in quantitative policy analysis, and then bring them back either as government officials or as analysts at places like RAND and so on and so forth. So it's got a momentum of its own now, but in those days it didn't. And so somehow or other, I approached the UCLA medical school, and through some friends I had over there, we created some joint appointments, which was a perfect way to go about it. So we had people who would make their clinical rounds over at the UCLA hospital. I'm glad I wasn't their patient. And then spend the rest of their time at RAND doing analytical work. Bob Brook, who now heads the health program, is a perfect example of that. He succeeds as director of that program a succession of three economists. The first was a fellow named Vince Taylor, I might have mentioned his name already, who operated strictly on RAND money, was essentially a solo operator because that's all the money we had. Then he left RAND, and Joe Newhouse, Al Williams became an economist, became director of the program. And then Joe Newhouse, I may have this order backwards, Joe Newhouse took over the program, and in any event was one of the most powerful analysts in the program. And our physicians tended to be analysts, yes, but also advisors more than leaders. That's been true of everybody up to Brook, who was sort of a human dynamo. As I had a professor at Yale, a professor of French named Henri Peyre, and people used to say about Peyre that he was the only man they knew who could go into the men's room, disappear into a stall, come out 3 minutes later, having peeled an apple, eaten it, done his business, and written another chapter in his latest book. That's the way Brook is. He's got his hands in everything, his mind is very agile, and he's tremendously productive. So, but he has worked with a lot of economists, and he's surrounded himself in the health program now with people who are more than competent economists. So, to go back then, when I was looking for people, I wanted people who were eager to do this, not people who wanted to be, who had to be dragooned into it. I was never, for example, going to get Bill Graham, who was the head of the electronics department, who was against the whole thing from the word go, to come and work. I did try to attract Victor Galinsky, who was a physicist, and I guess I enticed him to lead a civil technology program. But civil technology at RAND has inevitably led to garbage trucks, and it's not been a fruitful area. And so that program came and went. And that was the end of that, in spite of the fact that Victor was very eager to do it. So, as I say, we started out with this half dozen areas with the notion that they were not cast in concrete. There was at least one leader, if not a small core group of individuals, who were competent and motivated and interested in doing the work. They were a more or less congenial bunch of brigands. That is to say, they all knew each other, they worked with each other, so that the guy who was running education could work with the guy who was running justice, could work with the person who was running something else. And I spent a lot of my time, maybe more than I needed to, in trying to see that these people were sort of brought together, that their needs were met, that they were treated as something special within the RAND complex, and that their work would be properly represented outside, that I would create opportunities for them to brief secretaries and assistant secretaries and so on, and in the various agencies, that I would try to help make it financially possible for them to do what they were doing by participating in the money-raising process, and even by innovating from time to time. We had a thing called the Urban Program, which was led? It had three leaders. It had an economist, it had a sociologist, and let's see, two economists and a sociologist who worked together on a common research design, which was worked out between them and me, on comparing, contrasting, and analyzing the differences among three major American cities, Seattle, San Jose, California, and St. Louis. You have, obviously, the third, a dying city. You have San Jose, the fastest growing city in the country at the time. And you have Seattle, which rides a roller coaster. As Boeing goes, so goes Seattle. And at the time, they were, as I believe, they were bottoming out. So we were trying to study their economies and compare them and that sort of thing. But again, two economists, one sociologist. One of the economists has died. One of them is now back working international policy problems. Why, I don't know. And sociologist is Barbara Williams, who's a vice president. So that's the way we went about formulating things. We had lots of reviews. I instituted a beginning of project review in which a seminar was given when we established a new program or a new project. All the domestic people were invited to come. I introduced a procedure for reviewing projects in mid-course, not as a disciplinary sort of thing, but as a way of making sure people were on the right track and getting them help that they might need or not have recognized that they needed. And then at the end of each project, we had an end of project review, which was a formal review and involved not only other researchers, but also people from the public affairs office who would have to do press releases, and other people who would be from the publications department who would be concerned with putting together the report or the book or whatever was coming out. So I did all I could to create a feeling of team effort. And by and large, among an all-female opera company, I think I succeeded to a remarkably high degree. People generally liked each other. and saw themselves as united in something new and exciting and that they wanted to do. And that's kind of the way we went about forming the division, and that's the way I tried to replace people as we would lose somebody or as we would need new skills. Now, I mentioned at lunch that, or after lunch, that we brought on many people who were considered by the old line Randites as oddballs. We brought on psychologists, social psychologists, more sociologists, people with academic backgrounds that generally had not been represented in Rand, or at least not to any significant extent before. And they were thrown in the political science department, which was then renamed the social science department. But then there was a split into a political science, back to a political science department, and a, I think it started out as a social science department, although it was all political scientists. Then when we threw all these odds and sods in there, it became a social science department. Then it was recognized that there was probably a need for a better home than just mixing them up with all those political scientists in a department which, after all, was dominated by national security interests. So we created the Behavioral Sciences Department. And Barbara Williams of Sociology was head of that. And into that department, we put all the behavioral scientists and the sociologists. That department no longer exists. In fact, the departments no longer exist, which is a subject we might want to get into. Complete acceptance in Rand. And so we hired an awful lot of new people with very different backgrounds. And fortunately for us, the academic job market in that particular period was not so red hot that we couldn't get people who were willing, good people, who were willing to work in either defense or non-defense areas, although their preference was clearly in work in non-defense. Right. So they would, as it were, take the pledge. I mean, we never put it that way, but when we probed, if we found a an extremist. Whose principal interest was applying the principles of Marxism to national health in the United States, generally believed that the Russians ought to take over the world, we weren't too eager to bring him on board, even though his use would be maybe appropriate for a time in the domestic division. So that's the way the whole thing was formed. We had a principle of sort of every tub on its own financial bottom, and I believe in decentralization, and so I tried to decentralize the division as much as I could, aside from the functions that I've described a moment ago, and aside from lending a hand with liaison and fundraising and getting people introductions into the right places, so that the head of the education program, I don't know why I keep using that as an example, because it wasn't a great program. Most education programs aren't. Never had to feel that I was looking over his shoulder and I was going to threaten him with this and change that and overrule his agenda. But he did know that at the end of each phase of a project or at the end of each project, he was going to have to meet a quality control standard set by his peers, and that I would participate in that. They also knew that I vetted every proposal that went out, and that I generally turned mean when I saw one that I thought was inferior, and that would lead either to discussion and change, or filing in the in the circular file.
The way you say that, Gus, sounds kind of ominous.
Well, it seemed to work pretty well. And because I think people understood that whether my head was in the right place or not, my heart was in the right place. And what I was trying to do was to make them better than they appeared to be in that proposal. And once they saw that was the motivation, then I don't think they felt threatened. But I could be wrong. You may find out from talking with some of them.
Let me just ask, for as the program began to build up, was there much, or how would you characterize the interchange between the people in the domestic area versus the national security area? I mean, perhaps at two levels. One would be a professional level. Would there be interchange and discussion of problems in any sense? And then just personal contacts, whether, you know, in terms of just informal groupings of friends and acquaintances, and how people just sort of fell out in their patterns of interaction in the corporation.
Well, I would say that you had a U-shaped curve, and with a very steep slope. And I would say that 40% of RAND worked exclusively on national security, 40% of RAND worked exclusively on domestic, and a dubious 20% worked across that boundary. And so there was not a lot of interchange. Now, some of that began to change when the RAND collective decided that there was a need for a military health program, which was surely right. There was surely a need. And many of the people in the domestic health program went back and interacted with the defense people and helped them set up a useful and productive program. Similarly, we had a large military manpower program. When the domestic division got into the issues of manpower training, manpower development and training, employment, and so on, there was a substantive overlap there, and the domestic people benefited from the experience and the methods developed in the National Security Division. But by and large, this sort of artificial distinction was pretty well preserved in reality. And socially, the groupings existed independent of one another. Intellectually, they were independent of one another. Professionally, as I said before, the domestic people came from more of an academic tradition in which they saw themselves not only as solving problems, but as becoming or maintaining their rank as first-rate exes, sociologists, social psychologists, lawyers, whatever. Whereas on the national security side, people valued most highly having a direct impact on national security decision making, however that fell out and however they had to do it, and really lost identity with their academic disciplines. So naturally you could see how the two groups would tend to kind of segregate. I've always argued that, you know, it has only been a convenience and perhaps an unfortunate one that we organized RAND with that split.
What were the other options? Were there other options? I mean, how else might it have been done?
Well, we could have just kept it, I suppose, new programs. But the way it developed, there was a clear split, and it was recognized. The problem was that we didn't see, and I don't think we see today, the interconnections between the two. We have never done, for example, which I several times urged us to do, an overall budget. which would look at allocations to national security and allocations to domestic programs. I think part of the reason was concern that if we did it, how it would come out. It would look like a political instrument advocating either increased defense spending or increased allocation to domestic work. And so I was unsuccessful in persuading people to do that. But, you know, to me, the real security of the United States lies in our internal strength and only secondarily on our military prowess. And when I graduated from the Board of Trustees, in my farewell remarks, I said, you know, I hope that within my lifetime I'll see RAND live to understand that the domestic RAND at work is the sort of the rationale d'etre for the national security operation in the United States. There's no use having a mighty armed establishment with nothing to defend. And nobody threw me out of the room, so I think that many of the trustees, Newton Minow was another person who was always, you know, let's keep moving, let's keep going, let's do more and more domestic work. And when he was chairman, that was very helpful. Of course, he was also chairman during the Ellsberg period. And but that's, we've been sort of over that before.
Right. One thing I think one of your insights early on when we, you know, when you talked about doing the soft study and talking to Ed Barlow and the possibility of doing domestic research was a sense that the analytic techniques, the various tools that RAND had developed could be applied to other problem areas. Did that turn out to be the case? I mean, were the techniques employed in approaching military problems pretty much the same ones that you ended up using in approaching domestic problems?
Well, it depended very, very much on the subject area. I would say the general rule is that we tend in the domestic area not to address substantive problems in a given area with the conventional tools of that area. That is to say, when we had people who had, what's that funny degree they give in education?
No idea.
It's not a PhD in education.
It's a P-Ed or something. I'm not quite sure. Or Ed Doc or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Doctor of Education.
Right.
We had a few of those. They were awful, in my opinion. They did very conventional things in very conventional ways, and I don't think made much of a contribution at all to what we were trying to do. The real contributors were the economists like Steve Carroll, John Pincus, several others who really kind of got dug in there. Every once in a while we got lucky. We had a wonderful woman in the Washington office, Linda Darling Hammond, who was trained in education. I think she had a PhD. You know, I'm not really one to be very degree conscious, but I am very sensitive to the EDD, that's what it's called, as being definitely something to avoid in RAND analysis. And she was terrific. Wonderful, wonderful insights. Solid producer, well-respected outside, but very unorthodox in her methods. She applied, she was closer to, she knew the substance of education better, she applied analytical tools. Unfortunately, she was so good that she was stolen from us by one of our own trustees, who was also on the board at Columbia, and she's at Columbia University now, just up here, where the president of Teachers College is also a graduate of the RAND education work, a fellow named Mike Timpain. So we've disseminated a number of these people, either voluntarily or involuntarily, into the outside world. And as I said to my friend Jay Greer this morning, after we discovered last night that in church, his wife was overheard mentioning my name, and the woman next to her said, "You mean Gus Schubert?" Rand people turn up everywhere, just like German cockroaches. And I think it's just amazing what a small world it is. Now, some problems, such as the scheduling of police patrols, such as the optimal number of people in any given floor space for a prison, are much more amenable to analysis using Rand's traditional tools than others. An example from the health field. We did the health insurance experiment, which initially was designed to answer really only one question, which was a purely economic question. What is the response? What is the demand response to people covered with various levels of health insurance to that insurance coverage? Straight economic question. To the extent that straight economic analysis was a RAND tool, we used it. But very quickly we realized that that was only one of the major questions. The second question was, how did the consumption of health care affect health status? So then we looked around for tools, and we were able to develop statistical tools and statistical methods which grew out of the RAND tradition, the RAND methodological tradition, but were not RAND methods in the sense that calculating orbits would be. But they were in the RAND tradition of being rigorous, quantitative, recreatable, and so on, which are used to measure health status. And then the third question, of course, became, given that you have insurance coverage X and you consume quantity of health care services Y, what is the impact on your health? So we had to develop a whole set of tools to try to measure both impact on health and to measure the quality of care delivered and the interrelationships between those two things. So again, it's methods in the RAND tradition. So there is this range from, let's say, the OR work, essentially OR systems analysis work that we did on the fire department, for the fire department, with the fire department in New York City, which is straight RAND methodology, to more innovative things like the health work, which is nonetheless in the RAND tradition. And then when you get into, as if health weren't sticky enough, I use education again as an example, and I may have cited this earlier. We used to present briefings to the board, and we'd have one national security, then we'd have one domestic. I don't know why Don did that. I couldn't talk him out of it. But anyway, we had a presentation on a space-based weapon system. Now, of course, that system didn't exist. It was in somebody's head. But the whole briefing was about how this system would work, assuming it worked at all. And so all the answers were carried out to three decimal places. The briefing was crisp. It was clear. I mean, you're throwing up one chart after another on the wall of these precision orbits and all everything measured out and trajectories and aim points and degrees of accuracy and so on and so on. The board sat there and they watched this stuff. Oh, boy, you know, this is the real stuff. And that was followed by a briefing on some subject, I've forgotten which, in the education field. And that was received, I can say, with a general raspberry. And I was asked to step up to the front of the room and to explain why I couldn't lead a domestic division which would produce results like the results produced by that space weapons study and carry all my results out to three decimal points and things would be crisp and clear and no questions at the end. Everybody understands everything, and that's that. And so I had the, in some ways pleasurable, but in some ways painful, task of explaining to people that well, the obvious differences between the two fields, the different kinds of variables that that you're dealing with, the randomness of human behavior as compared with the behavior of objects put into space with a certain amount of power at a certain time of day, month, year, decade, and so on and so forth. And while they swallowed all that, they did not like it. And it was clear I walked away from there with the feeling that in spite of the fact I thought I'd done a pretty good job of explaining the difference, they didn't find it satisfying. Since I mentioned New York, if you're going to go on to a new tape, maybe I should start out, because it's relevant in several aspects. I'll answer any questions you have, and then we can go on to that, because it relates to selecting projects and
okay.
structures and that sort of thing.